Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. This has been a bad week in Afghanistan. More than 100 people have been reported killed in the deadliest fighting since the Taliban was ousted from power 5 years ago. The latest round of attacks, which includes suicide bombings, comes just months before the planned takeover of military activities in the country by NATO forces. New York Times reporter Carlotta Gall is covering the situation in Afghanistan. She joins us on the line from Pakistan. Welcome, Carlotta.
Thank you.
Can you tell us why there's been this sudden increase in fighting and where these resources for apparent Taliban insurgents are coming from?
Every year in the spring, because a lot of the Taliban work in the mountains where they have safe places to hide. So when the snows melt, you always see an uptick in fighting and in activities. But this year has been particularly bad. As NATO forces are deploying, a lot of them are suggesting that it's the Taliban and their backers trying to send a message to NATO troops, trying to disrupt the deployment and the confidence, I think, of the different nations that are making up the NATO force.
Why does it appear that there's been increased support or funds or confidence or whatever you want to call it for the Taliban?
Well, we're just picking up sophistication in their bombs. You know, there's a lot of roadside bombs or mines under the road. These are remote controlled, and the coalition forces, mostly Americans that have been operating in the south, are saying that there is an increase in the sophistication of the devices, which implies training and perhaps outside input in gearing up the Taliban insurgents. There's also clearly funds, because they've got better weapons, and a lot of the people captured you know, explain that they've been paid money to do operations. Some of it's coming from the Gulf, some of it's coming from Pakistan.
Could you interpret this to mean that there's increased support for the Taliban and this is a statement against the West in Afghanistan?
I don't think we can say the people are supporting the Taliban by choice, but we are aware that many of them cooperate with the Taliban or don't confront them because they're scared. The Taliban have used some brutal tactics in the countryside, not only targeting foreign forces, but targeting Afghans, you know, tribal elders, teachers, mullahs, and so on. So the general population is very scared. I think in Afghanistan, people are so weary of war that they see them as armed people who come through and cause trouble. But Afghans, especially in the south, are particularly religious. They also have a long history of resistance to foreign armies. So that does play very strongly in their view. So if they have a mullah who is always a respected religious figure coming through and telling them that, you know, it's wrong to have infidels or foreign forces in your country, the people will rise to that and act on that because they feel it's their duty as Muslims. I think when it comes to fighting for their country, they wouldn't buy that, but they would fight for their religion.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai has been very critical of this violence. He's implied that these insurgents may be getting trained and may be getting more sophisticated across the border in Pakistan.
Yes, and the Afghan officials are not the only people saying it. Privately, many of the military officials in the NATO force that's coming in and the American coalition force will tell you that they at least have safe haven in Pakistan. The funding is also thought to come from there, even if some of the funding comes from the poppy harvest in Afghanistan.
There are reports today, Carlotta, that U.S.-led coalition forces captured a top Taliban leader, Mullah Dadullah.
Yes, this is very exciting if it's true. He's one of the most wanted of all the Taliban leaders because he's one of the top commanders. If he was captured, he could be tried for war crimes in Afghanistan because he led many of the battles during the Taliban regime against other Afghans in the country.
Do you think this violence is going to affect the timetable for NATO to take over military activities in Afghanistan?
They won't be deterred. The members of NATO that are going to the south are the British predominantly and the Canadians, who are very tough and I think very committed.
New York Times reporter Carlotta Gall is covering the situation in Afghanistan. She joined us on the line from Pakistan. Thank you, Carlotta.
Thank you.
A committee at Brown University is preparing to release a report on the school's relationship to slavery. The report is sensitive on several levels. It's being written by a committee established by the university's president, Ruth Simmons, a great-granddaughter of slaves and the first African-American woman president of an Ivy League university. And the university, located in Providence, Rhode Island, was founded by John and Moses Brown, two brothers with very different but very strong connections to slavery. Their lives play out in the new book, Sons of Providence, The Brown Brothers, The Slave Trade, and the American Revolution. The author is journalist Charles Rapley, and he joins me in the studio. Charles, when you were asked for modern-day comparisons to John and Moses Brown, you compared John to Enron founder Ken Lay and Moses to consumer advocate Ralph Nader. Can you explain that?
I was intrigued by how these brothers were cut from the same cloth and came out in such different characters. And John was a profiteer during the Revolutionary War. He was also a firebrand patriot. But he always figured out a way to make money off of what was going on around him. And Moses Brown was John's partner in their first early venture in the slave trade, the voyage of the Sally to Africa. Half of their slaves died on that trip, and it provoked in Moses a crisis of conscience. He became a Quaker, and he became an early and ardent abolitionist. So he fits that mold of the American social reformer, the kind of person who takes social obligations as his own and makes that his mission.
And you know what I thought was interesting was that they were the fifth generation of their family in the New World.
Rhode Island had already established what you would call the American character. They were fiercely independent, defiant of authority. It was the place that first separated church from state. They were the first functioning democracy since Athens. So you see the Browns raised in this tradition of liberty and freedom. They took their different views from the same tradition. John, his version of freedom was freedom to seize economic opportunity wherever he saw it. And Moses took that tradition as an obligation to protect liberties and freedoms of individuals, even including the enslaved Africans in America.
Where did the family make its money before it got into the slave trade?
Well, they followed in the steps of their father, James Brown, and he was a merchant. And the first three generations of the family were Baptist preachers on both sides, mother and father. So they came from this strong religious tradition. But James broke off from that. He married the daughter of a merchant, and he became a merchant himself. So John and Moses grew up in the family firm. They traded with the Caribbean, and they diversified early. Obadiah Brown, their uncle, started a chocolate mill. He started a candle factory. And you see John Brown, when he was just 20, helping to organize the candle makers in that part of New England to set the price for whale oil. Price fixing was legal in those days, and it was a mark of his early sophistication, John's, in the ways of business, that he was able to get this cartel organized and keep a lid on the price of their primary input for candles.
And rum was also very, very much a staple of their business.
They ran a rum distillery. And rum was a staple of the African slave trade, which was, as not many people recognize, was headquartered in Newport, Rhode Island, the American end of the African slave trade. And that was the triangle trade, where they would bring molasses from the Caribbean, distill it at Newport, ship it out as rum to Africa, trade the rum for slaves, take the slaves to the Caribbean, and load up more molasses. The Mariners of Rhode Island made money at every corner of the triangle, and it was the source of some of the great fortunes of Newport at the time. And slavery was just considered part of the backdrop. But as people started to raise objections, the answer they got from the slave traders, and in particular from John Brown, was, look, there's too much money in this. We're not going to let go of it. We're not going to allow the British and the French to continue the slave trade and let all the profits go to them. Hmm. It was a free trade argument, and they stuck to it.
And when you mention Moses and his abolitionist work, Moses Brown and his abolitionist work, what I thought was interesting was that although I may have known that he did this, I didn't realize that it took him a long time to come to it. And he actually had slaves himself, and it was years after after the failure of the ship Sally, when the, yes. when so many slaves lost their lives, that he did come about and renounce slavery, really.
The failure of the Sally was a financial failure for the firm, but it didn't become a moral question until 6 years later, Moses Brown's wife died. And he says, as he told the story, he was at her grave, and he had a vision where he saw his own six slaves crying out to him for freedom. And Moses considered this a sign that God had taken his wife from him as punishment for his role in the slave trade. And you see, when you're looking at the early movement for abolition, it seemed to start with people having these epiphanies and individually making this moral decision that they're going to commit themselves to the opposition of slavery. Then, as you approach the time of the Revolution, you have all this rhetoric explaining their opposition to British rule in terms of liberty and freedom. And as that rhetoric caught on, the recognition seemed to spread and catch up with the Quakers, who were the real leaders in the abolition movement. That recognition caught on that liberty and freedom was a contradiction in a place with people laboring in chains. But Moses, he had this epiphany. He set free his six slaves. He became a Quaker, and he started from there forward committing himself to abolition. He wrote the first laws in the Americas to end slavery. He wasn't successful in them, but he was pushing them. And he wrote the first law anywhere to make it illegal to engage in the slave trade. And that law, when it was passed in 1787 in Rhode Island, that was his crowning triumph, really.
Charles Rapley is author of the book Sons of Providence, The Brown Brothers, The Slave Trade, and The American Revolution. After the break, how the brothers' feud over slavery spills onto the pages of Rhode Island newspapers and thoughts on what Brown University should do about its connection to the slave trade. Coming up later in the program, language makes its way into the debate on immigration. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Deborah Becker, it's Here and Now. We're continuing our conversation with Charles Rapley, author of the new book, Sons of Providence, The Brown Brothers, The Slave Trade, and The American Revolution. Charles, before the break, we were talking about Moses Brown's opposition to slavery. And as you note, his argument with John, his slave trading brother, also played out in local newspapers at the time. Tell us about that.
When Moses Brown first went to the legislature, it was in 1784. He introduced this ban on engagement in the slave trade, prohibition on slave trading. And to his surprise, the person who led the opposition to that bill was John Brown. And John Brown brought in witnesses, he spoke eloquently, and he defeated Moses's bill by a 2-1 vote. But the movement for abolition was growing, and in 1787, 3 years later, Moses came back to the legislature and passed his bill unanimously. John was silent in the face of that, and in fact he wrote his brother that he would get out of the slave trade in deference to his brother Moses. But in 1789, 2 years after that, Moses formed the Providence Abolition Society. It's not clear what provoked John at that point. But for some reason, he reacted in the most vitriolic fashion, and he started writing letters to the paper, as you said, under the pseudonym The Citizen, denouncing the abolitionists and arguing that the institution of slavery was a healthy one for American society and even for the blacks that were brought over in chains. Moses wrote back, and there was this remarkable exchange that went on for months in the papers.
Is that where you found a lot of your information for the book, in looking through sort of newspaper clippings like that, some of the, maybe the public records of business transactions, if there were such things at the time? I mean, that sounds very painstaking to try to put this picture together.
The primary source that I relied on was the correspondence of Moses Brown, which included a lot of John's letters as well. And you can actually go down to Providence City Hall and see the handwritten ledgers of the town meetings from 1772 and 74, when the whole conflict with England was just boiling up. And it's quite fascinating.
What did you find about how the two brothers felt about the war at the time and what was happening? Were they in agreement on that front anyway? Or?
In fact, that was the first time they had their falling out. John's great claim to fame, at least until now, was his leadership in the raid on the Gaspee, which was a British revenue ship that was interrupting his customary smuggling activities. It got stuck on a sandbar one afternoon. John rallied his sea captains and his crews in the taverns on the waterfront in Providence, and around midnight one night, they climbed into longboats, they rowed down the 7 miles down to where the Gaspee was stranded. They went over the rail like a bunch of pirates, took the crew captive, and burned the ship. Consequently, John was a firebrand patriot leader when the revolution finally arrived. But Moses had already had his crisis of conscience, had become a Quaker, and was a committed pacifist. So they disputed the whole question of the revolution. And while John spent the war selling gunpowder and cannon to Washington's army, at a markup, of course, Moses spent the war distributing aid to families left destitute by the fighting.
So what was the relationship then like between these two brothers? Did they ever, were they close? Did they ever reconcile? What happens?
Well, that's one of the things that really drew me to this story is how they remained connected to each other despite all these divisions. They grew up together. They went to school together. They were in their family firm for some years together. And they together led the move to bring Rhode Island College, later named Brown University, to bring it to Providence. So they collaborated closely. They had a very high regard for each other, at least in terms of their mutual respect for their business acumen and their political abilities. But they were quite different people. John was a person of great ambition. He took a lot of risks in his business practices. He had huge appetites. He was physically imposing. He was just over 5 feet tall and weighed more than 350 pounds. Moses was in many ways his opposite. He was slim. He was abstentious. After the revolution, he didn't even drink tea. He drank herb tea. And you see these people as different as night and day, but still sharing this family bond that they never renounced. And you find that even at the height of their dispute over the slave trade, when they're slandering each other in the newspapers and leading counterattacks in the legislature and finally in court, at the same time, they collaborated on launching the First Bank of Providence, which was the fifth bank of the United States. And even toward the end of their lives, you see them signing their letters as your affectionate brother, your loving brother, talking about each other's families, their children. So you get a sense that no matter what else was going on, it never shook their allegiance to each other.
What do you think Brown University should do about its ties to slavery? A committee is looking into the school's ties to slavery, and a committee is going to issue a report about this and possibly about the issue of reparations. What do you think?
I think it's a tough question to answer. I think reparations is obviously simplistic and difficult. It's hard to say where that would end. How much is enough? And can you really spend your way out of a legacy? I think also that for Brown to be confronting its history of involvement with slavery, it's to be commended, but I don't see how they can distinguish themselves from any other institution that dates back to that time. You can take Harvard or Yale or any of the businesses that go back that far, and they have the same question to answer.
Charles Rapley is author of Sons of Providence, The Brown Brothers, The Slave Trade, and The American Revolution. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here Rebecca, in for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Amid the release of a Spanish version of the U.S. national anthem, there's movement in the Senate to declare English the national language, and President Bush is supporting the move. White House Press Secretary Tony Snow says the president agrees with both of the amendments tacked on to the Senate immigration bill. One would make English the national language, the other would make it the common unifying language. For more on the immigration debate, we turn to Rick Klein of the Boston Globe. And Rick, first of all, can you explain the difference between these two amendments on English being whatever language it's going to be of the country?
I don't think anyone can explain the difference, unfortunately. Basically what's going to happen is that these two conflicting amendments, one saying that English should be the official language of the United States, and another saying that there shouldn't be any change to the availability of other languages in government documents and the like, it's all going to get worked out in the next couple of weeks. I think this was emblematic of the shifting alliances we've seen in Congress over this, the passions in Congress, and the political worries. I think a lot of people in the Senate felt like they had to vote in favor of English, and they want to be seen as backing another language in favor of English. But they also didn't want to seem, as in the words of Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, that they were being racist in the process. So I think the senators themselves were confused about their actual intent and wanted to send signals that actually are conflicting.
When somebody starts saying that things are racist, I imagine that the debate gets very emotional. How emotional was it?
It has been. It's really been a remarkable couple of days. I mean, covering Congress, I'm used to a lot of debate that's pretty canned, where you hear predictable arguments from one side and predictable arguments from the other side, and the vote is predetermined. That's not at all what's going on in this debate. I mean, there is real discussion, a real hashing through and working through of the tough issues around immigration. It's such a complicated issue. The politics are not obvious for anyone, either Democrats or Republicans, liberals or conservatives, that we're seeing real debate, real passionate debate on the floor of the Senate. It's something, you know, we should probably don't get enough of in Washington.
What about language services? And if English is declared the national language, what would happen? What are we talking about, Rick?
Well, they basically watered down the English as the official language amendment to the point where it cannot be read as taking away from other provisions and other languages that are already out there. So that, by that I mean if a state has decided to print up its ballots in Spanish as well as in English or in other languages as well, it can't now backtrack on that because of this declaration. So it sort of freezes in place what's already there. The concern is that it may have a chilling effect on efforts by other states, other municipalities, the federal government to expand the access in foreign languages of official documents.
What about some of the other amendments, Rick, that have come forward in this whole debate over this immigration legislation?
We have seen over the last few days the Senate legislation get a little bit stricter, actually a lot bit stricter, I'd say, in some ways. They've limited the number of visas that would be available to temporary workers. They have limited the ability of a of someone who's now here on an undocumented basis to appeal for his own citizenship, to apply and petition for himself. They're going to force the employer to get involved in that to a greater extent. They also, and this is the highest profile and most controversial move so far this week, the Senate endorsed a wall similar to the House wall, though somewhat smaller, more directed, but nonetheless a significant border fence. Triple layer of barbed wire, the whole like, that will be along the U.S.-Mexico border. And one of the senators who sponsored it said, good fences make good neighbors. And that was an endorsement by the Senate. It was, more than 80 senators ended up voting for that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that this bipartisan coalition of lawmakers will be able to stay together here?
It's hard to say. They're taking it on a very much a vote-by-vote, a case-by-case basis. I mean, every amendment that comes up is a different coalition, and the people who are working to maintain this bipartisan compromise are sometimes voting against each other, even though they agree on the substance of the bill as a whole. So it's not clear exactly what the path is and exactly what it will be, and we could very easily get to a point where the conservatives are pleased with it, and the liberals decide that they hate it now, and all of a sudden the whole compromise falls apart.
So do you think that we will see a final vote anytime soon?
I think the Senate Majority Leader, Bill Frist, has guaranteed a final vote by the end of next week. That doesn't guarantee passage, of course. It doesn't guarantee who's voting for it. If this becomes a Republican-only bill, it certainly changes its prospects. It actually makes it more likely to become law, but less likely to be accepted by a lot of people as a legitimate answer to the issue. The biggest obstacle will remain, I mean, regardless of what the Senate does over the next week, the House is extremely skeptical about the provisions that provide a path to legalization, a path to citizenship for people who broke the law by coming here. That is going to be tough to break, especially as we draw closer. Every day we get closer to the November elections, that sort of skepticism is going to be harder to overcome.
Hmm. All right. Rick Klein covers Congress for the Boston Globe. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, 27 states have laws designating English as the official language, but one border community in Texas actually has Spanish as its official language. El Ceniso, Texas, is a city of 6,500 people near Laredo. In 1999, city leaders decided to conduct business in Spanish. Raul Reyes is the 22-year-old mayor of El Ceniso, and he joins us on the line. And Mayor Reyes, why did your community decide to make Spanish the official language?
The city of El Ceniso passed an ordinance having our city council meetings in Spanish so we can communicate better with the residents and hear their problems. You know, I think there is a great need and a hunger for our community to get involved in politics and get involved in the decisions that the city council, made.
And what do you think of the U.S. Senate decision to make English the national language of the country?
I feel it's something important that we all need to, understand that we're in the United States and we just need to respect the language of the United States. And, if it's English, then, we all have to learn English.
Mm-hmm. So you support this?
Yes, I do.
What do you think of the Spanish national anthem?
I'm kind of in disagreement with that. I think there's two things very sacred to every nation, and that's our national anthem and their flag. And I think we all need to respect those two things. And, I'm not happy with the fact that the national anthem was translated into Spanish.
Hmm. Do you still conduct your city meetings in Spanish?
We conduct our city council meetings bilingual, in English and in Spanish.
So would you say that Spanish is the official language of El Ceniso?
I would say it is. I would say it is. Even if the United States passes an ordinance to make English the national language, you can't really change a community that has, this background like El Ceniso. Communities across the U.S.-Mexican border that can identify themselves speaking more Spanish than English, and you'll see that a lot in these areas.
Well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Okay, thanks.
Raul Reyes is mayor of El Ceniso, Texas, a Mexican border city that passed a measure making Spanish its official language in 1999. Still to come, Russian choral music resonates with a choir in Maine. You're listening to Here and Now. With almost two dozen states now requiring a standardized test as a high school graduation requirement, some communities are launching legal challenges. In California, the fight has gone to the state Supreme Court, and some 47,000 diplomas are on the line for students who have not passed an exit exam. In Arizona, a judge has upheld that state's exam, which means about 1,000 seniors will not receive their high school diplomas this year. In New Bedford, Massachusetts, Mayor Scott Lang is suggesting something else. He wants to award general diplomas to students who meet educational requirements but do not pass the state exam called the MCAS. The mayor says this high-stakes testing hurts students and increases his city's dropout rate. I asked him to explain why some students should be allowed to graduate without passing the test.
The MCAS system is based on two criteria. One is you have to meet your local graduation requirements, which means 13 years of being involved in everything from testing, you know, by your teachers, midterms, finals, whatever it is, the social fabric of your school. That makes a person. That's the learning process. Then you superimpose on that the one-shot test. It seems to me that I don't have a problem with the children passing a one-shot test, but I don't want to relegate the kids who can't pass it to dropout status, which means no college, no job, no living wage, which basically means for the rest of our lives and their lives, society will be paying the price for not recognizing their accomplishment. In Massachusetts also, you should know that private and parochial schools don't have an MCAS test, so their local graduation requirements are validated. They're getting into colleges. They're competing in all the different job areas. They may be getting scholarship money. They're getting into all the opportunities. And the kids who meet the local graduation requirements have nothing. So it doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. But if they do have more than one chance to take this test and
right.
try to pass it, and if there can be accommodations made when there are special needs involved or a student for some reason or another needs those accommodations, then why not focus on trying to get these students to pass the test so then everybody is on the same page?
That's the perfect question, and I love that question, because the fact is originally, for instance, in Massachusetts, in New Bedford, Mass., we had $800,000 each year from the state for remediation to make sure that kids can pass this test, which, by the way, seems to me to be completely illogical, because it's the equivalent of setting up a Kaplan review course for the MCAS. But we had $800,000 to do that. We are now down to $109,000. The fact is, with this graduation, we'll be up to 150 children who were unable to pass the MCAS who got a certificate of attendance over the last 4 years. In the state of Massachusetts, it will be over 5,000 children who met every local graduation requirement, couldn't pass this test for whatever reason, who get a worthless certificate of attendance. And this is really what the debate's about. Why do we want to relegate those kids who bought into our system? Not only our local school systems and communities, but the American system, basically, which is stay in school, get an education. Why do we want to relegate them to a dropout status? And you can say, well, the key here, then, is getting them to pass the test. Well, then, isn't that just, you know, again, the ultimate pass-through? We're building a Trojan horse of failure here based on this idea that your diploma is only valid if you've been able to pass the MCAS. What we've advocated in New Bedford is we will issue an MCAS diploma, which recognizes that the young student met all the local graduation requirements and also passed the state-required MCAS. What we're simply suggesting is if they don't pass the MCAS, what we offer is a New Bedford school department general diploma, which will designate that they met all local graduation requirements under Chapter 69 of the law. I mean, this is form over substance, and it's dictating future, you know, hardships and economic difficulties for many, many students now. And as we know, a dropout status will require state aid in the form of welfare assistance, state medical payments in the form of a health care plan. Why would we want to build in those costs when we should recognize success, not come up with artificial failures?
Mayor Lang, you're going to offer these diplomas June 15th at graduation?
That's correct.
Okay, well, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Scott Lang is the mayor of New Bedford, Massachusetts. He's proposing a tiered system of awarding diplomas to high school graduates so that seniors who do not pass a standardized test would be allowed to graduate with a diploma. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. When you think of Maine, maybe lobster, skiing, or a rocky coastline come to mind. But Russian sacred choral music appears to have found a home there, too. The Down East Singers is a community chorus based in the town of Camden that works with the Bowdoin College Chorus from Brunswick. Over the past decade, they've toured the country performing Rachmaninoff's Russian Orthodox Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. What makes this Russian music resonate with a bunch of Mainers? Well, radio producer, chorus member, and daughter of conductor Tina Antolini takes us along on a concert tour to find out.
Hillary Carr doesn't speak Russian, but she can sing it. In fact, she loves singing it.
This music, this particular music, is, I find, goes way inside of me. I found it very dark when I first heard it, but I really feel it just takes you way inside, and there's kind of this magic connection among all the members of the choir.
Hillary is one of 115 Mainers, myself included, who spend a lot of time singing Russian. We're of every age and profession, from massage therapist to college student to the manager of a fish packing plant. But as members of the Rachmaninoff Festival Choir, we regularly sing a Russian mass.
So here's the beginning of a 16 on 105, please.
Tonight's the final rehearsal before the start of this season's performances, and some singers are still getting stuck on the tricky harmonies and Russian vowels. In a few days, we'll be singing in a Greek Orthodox church in Massachusetts. But tonight, conductor Tony Antolini is struggling with the details.
No.
Antolini has quite a history with this piece, Sergei Rachmaninoff's Mass for the Russian Orthodox Church. As a choral conductor in California, Antolini pulled the piece from near complete obscurity, recovering it from libraries where it had been hidden during the anti-religious Soviet era. Antolini's Californian chorus sang the first complete performance of the liturgy in the United States in 1986. When Antolini moved to Maine in 1991, the Rachmaninoff came too. Some members of this chorus have been singing the piece for over a decade. Antolini has attempted several times to retire the piece, but singers complain. People want to sing it again and again. Conductor Tony Antolini.
This is very unusual music to choristers because it is an hour and 20 minute long piece with no accompaniment. It's just the human voice. And that, for many singers, is an adventure in itself.
It's the group experience that's important to me.
Singer Steve Ferrand.
You are all trying to do, in some ways, the same thing at the same time, and there's something very powerful about that. It's like a group meditation, really, I think.
St. Vasilios Greek Orthodox Church has a giant blue dome that rises a surprise along the suburban Massachusetts skyline. And as the chorus walks inside, the aroma of roasting meat and spices contributes to the feeling that we've entered another world.
It smells so good.
Are we in heaven yet?
The famed Greek hospitality is apparent as soon as we walk in the door. Even before we've sung a note, the chorus is treated to a smorgasbord of Greek food.
Welcome to our home. Please step forward.
This is cheese pie and this spinach pie.
Spinach, please.
It's pasticcio. It's macaroni, hamburg with custard, filling.
Yes, please.
Would you like to
have
more?
One more? Yeah.
Sure.
But the Greek welcome extends far beyond the dining hall. During both performances, the audience is so emotionally engaged with the music that the air feels electrified. Several people weep. An elderly couple in the front row grips hands, their eyes closed, faces entranced. Father Andrew Damasis is the pastor at St. Vasilios.
Other people, when they hear that service, hear a performance. But Orthodox people hear a service that they have lived and has been a part of their lives forever. And so the tears that you see coming down people's cheeks are really joyful tears because they're experiencing something that someone who hasn't grown up in that tradition could never understand. I think the members of the choir do because they have deepened their experience of it by performing it so often and so well.
The singers themselves come from every imaginable religious background, Protestant, Catholic, Buddhist, atheist, and everything in between. But singing for an audience that receives the music so passionately enhances a sense of the spiritual nature of the Rachmaninoff for many choristers. Soprano Nancy Beckett is a physician's assistant from Cushing, Maine.
You know, the thing about St. Basilio's congregation was that the holiness of the service is the chant, and our music is that. And then beyond that, the quality of the Rachmaninoff is the very deep tones and the way the tones are put together. You know, it vibrates every molecule in you. It just connects you to the rest of the universe with an energy that can't be found in another way.
This sense of tapping into a world beyond ours is what Orthodox music is aiming for, says conductor Tony Antolini. In the Orthodox Church, he says, they use music as an aid to prayer and meditation, as a sort of window into another world.
When a person sings this or listens to it, it is meant to transport the person into almost a trance-like state. There's a very important place in the eighth movement of this piece, which is the cherubic hymn, which describes the angels. And it says, "Let us, like the angels, lay aside earthly care." And I think that's really the heart, the sum and substance of why this piece is so meaningful, is that everyone has cares. And when they sing this or hear it, people are able to lay aside earthly or worldly care.
For some choristers, though, this laying aside of earthly care is a bit more of a challenge. Nancy Beckett is one among several chorus members who are currently battling cancer. She says that singing this piece is part of her larger struggle to live with her illness.
It just takes you to a place that you need to be where it isn't, you know, dealing with cancer from moment to moment. I encourage myself and other people to assume that you're going to survive nicely for as long as you do, with some happiness and grace. You know, you just can't go hide in a hole. And music takes you out of your hole. I think it's a terrific focusing force.
For this community chorus, performing the Rachmaninoff has become a much larger experience than one of simple music making, of singing something exotically Russian. It has emerged as a meditation, a release, a healing, and for all of us from small town Maine and beyond, an exercise in joy.
Our piece was from radio producer Tina Antolini. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Temagawa, Alex Ashlock, Tara Murphy, Molly Hamill, Karen Miller-Medson, and Virginia Prescott. Doug Sugertz is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer is Kevin Donovan. The senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young is back Monday. Have a good weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.